This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
We have as our guest today Matt Gertkin, who is the Chief Geopolitical Strategist for Bank Credit Analysts. One of the favorite reports that I read in all the research that I do. I went through, Michael saw me, I was preparing for our next newsletter this morning, and I had a trash can, a big 22-gallon trash can kind of thing. It's about half full of all the stuff I threw away from all the reading, but I never throw Matt's stuff away. It's always right on and right on time. And Matt, you shocked me. I have to say that. It was a shock. I'm reading your special report, Five Black Swans for 2025. Now, I've read you for a long time, and I know you're not a sensationalist. You don't exaggerate. You don't overhype for marketing's sake. And when I read your report, I'm like, this is crazy. I did a double take. I'm like, wait a minute. What did he say? Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. So the audience, I have to keep suspended in animation about what you shocked me on. But I want, if it's okay with you, I want to start domestically. The Doge and the budget. I mean, I've lived through balanced budget amendment. I've lived through the, you know, the contract with America and all that stuff. This one looks like it might have some teeth, but that's not my specialty. My question, I guess, for you is, can it really work this time? How far can they take these budget cuts? Is it something we're really going to reform government and it's going to change the trajectory of the national debt of the U.S. government? What's your take, Matt?
Well, thanks, Jerry. Well, I do think it's going to be significant. I think you're right that the explosion of inflation that we saw in the wake of the pandemic has generated some political capital for cutting of red tape, deregulation of the economy, and also shaking up the bureaucracy. And President Trump's reelection was a historic comeback. And he, of course, had long been saying that he wanted to drain the swamp and shake up Washington. So I think that's all happening, and I think it's happening very quickly, so that we already will witness impacts from what's been done. Just, you know, cutting some agencies, firing different staff members. This is a huge shakeup of the federal government. But in terms of the size of government and the size of cuts, that's probably overrated. The original idea was a $2 or $2.5 trillion cut to spending over 10 years. And that has already been admitted to be not very likely by the House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's really looking at something closer to $1.3 or $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So they've already sort of cut in half the size of federal spending cuts that they think they can get away with. And even that, you know, I've looked at this issue just going through with a hatchet, not a scalpel. Right. Looking at non-defense discretionary spending, I was able to get $1.3 trillion on a – that's a very generous number. I mean, really, the federal cuts may not be that high. So spending cuts are hard to do because every single piece of spending has already been advocated for by Congress people, by lawmakers, and they're defending their districts. And so you can cut waste, but it'll probably prove a little bit disappointing. And then I'll conclude by saying that the impact of that for those who are listening is, well, it means that the tax cuts will have to, they'll be lowering revenue, but you won't get as much spending cuts as you expected. And therefore, the budget deficit impact will probably be larger than anticipated.
Well, I think that's right, but I wanted to hear your opinion on it. And I'm looking at it also, and I've looked at this issue for a long time. Let's just call it the demographic time bomb. You know, you've got, which supposedly goes broke in 2032, I think, which of course we know is more or less fictional anyway, because it's a, you know, it's a budgetary issue, and we all know the story. Congress already borrowed all the money out and spent it. So there's now a trust fund that you can carry around in a briefcase, you know, basically. But Medicare, of course, is the big gorilla. Everything I've seen, there's a guy named Ken Dykewald that wrote a book called Age Wave years ago. He pointed out that the issue with Medicare, he said, at this point, and I think this is still accurate, but this is a number of years ago, he said that vast majority of the expenses, something like two-thirds of all Medicare expenses, are incurred in the last 9 months of a fatal illness. Now we've got the baby boomers. As you know, we've talked extensively. I think you have our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond. We talk about demographics, demographics, and demographics. Now we have this monster, what to me looks like a ticking time bomb of entitlements. And if we don't turn the trajectory of the budget around, which again, I agree with you, I don't think it's going to turn the trajectory. We're kind of cutting around the edges, it looks like, in spite of everybody really working on it. Speak to that for a moment, because it looks to me like this is explosive. We know from Rogoff Reinhardt type guys that you reach a certain point where your government expenditures are too high and it's regressive on the economy. Talk a little bit about what I refer to as a demographic time bomb with the entitlements of the baby boomers.
Sure. Well, one thing is clear is that the Democratic Party did not want to reform entitlements, and the Republican Party under President Trump has said no reforms to entitlements. So that means that there is no political party today advocating structural reform of entitlement spending. There are Republicans individually who will do that, but they're kind of outnumbered. The Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in his Senate confirmation hearing also confirmed that this administration is not really aiming at cutting entitlements. And what we've seen just over the past week is we've seen sparring between the House Budget Committee chairman and the House Ways and Means Committee chairman over whether Medicare and Medicaid could be touched. It's the third rail of politics, and that was pretty well known. And the point of view of the Trump administration and this current Republican single party control that we have, they're really not wanting to deal with that long-term issue. The other thing is that to do that, they would have to alienate those baby boomer voters who right. you're referring to. And of course, you know, Congress people are not stupid. The next election is 21 months away.
Right.
So they're not going to go after people's retirements or their benefits, you know, in this kind of environment. What they really are going to have to do is make a break between, you know, I think that the debate is whether Generation X is going to see cuts to its entitlements or whether Generation X and the baby boomers will be given a free pass and then the millennials will see cuts to their entitlements. And I think that's probably the most likely is that over the next 10 years, inflationary forces will probably force Congress at some point to do something about entitlements. But it will be, and it, of course, it'll be taken, there'll be an element of cutting spending, but there'll also probably be at that time an element of raising taxes, and there'll probably be a higher inflation rate. And all those things will be means of trying to manage this problem. But it's probably the millennials and younger that will actually see their benefits rolled back. I don't think there's a political path to cutting what baby boomers will receive from the federal government.
Well, I agree with you on that for sure. And this is starting to remind me more and more of the late 70s, the Carter years, kind of like, okay, well, this sounds kind of familiar. I think I've seen this movie before. Let's jump into something a little more explosive. I mentioned on the beginning of the show that you shocked me. And I did a double take. I went, wait a minute. Let me go back and reread what I think he just said. And it was true. I've never seen you, and I'm saying this in positive, I've never seen you be a sensationalist, overestimate, try to exaggerate. To me, your analysis has been spot on and extremely accurate. And when I read that you said that the odds of a problem with a black swan, of course, we've been talking about black swans on our show for a number of months, but a black swan, something you can't necessarily predict is going to happen. Statistically, when I read your five black swans for 2025 newsletter, and by the way, if you want to get a copy of this, we'll see if we can get you a complimentary copy. Those of you, just send us an email. I'll ask the guys if they'll send out something, which I think would be beneficial for them to read. And it's on the front of it is Iran's nuclear program taking flight. And I'm looking at the advanced centrifuges of Iran. Of course, I'm not a nuclear expert, but before Trump took office, it looks like you're around 300 or 400 of them. And now we're at 12,000 of them in Iran. And when you said that, and this is where I did the double take, when you said the odds, in your opinion, of Israel taking on Iran in 2025 was 75%, that's where I went back and I did the double take. I went, wait. I've never seen him put that high of odds on anything. I agree with your analysis, but please elaborate to our audience what the heck is going on here. It looks to me like we could have an existential problem with the Middle East right now.
Yeah, thank you. Well, so I've been following the story my whole career. You know, we're 18 years for me watching this Iran saga. And ultimately, what the saga is about is whether Iran can obtain a nuclear weapon. And from their perspective, they need that in order to secure their regime over the long term, to make the Islamic revolution permanent. And that was the logic that other states used in obtaining nuclear weapons, including the Communist Party of China, which was very worried that they wouldn't be able to last forever, but they knew that a nuclear weapon would be their ticket to eternity. And most recently, we've seen North Korea obtain nuclear weapons after a series of negotiations with the U.S., where effectively when the U.S. was looking at them, they would freeze or conduct or negotiate or maybe even do a short deal. But then as soon as the U.S. looked the other direction, they would keep marching in the direction of their strategic objective, and they ultimately obtained it. Now, the dynamic is that the Iranians have learned from this process. They learned that, you know, if you're Pakistan or you're North Korea and you really stick to your guns, you will eventually obtain a nuclear weapon. On the other hand, if you trade it away on promises, you end up looking like Libya or Ukraine, both of which gave up nuclear weapons only to be invaded later. So the Iranians have a very clear calculus, a strategic calculus, which is bent on deterrence. And they also are going through some internal problems as well. Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, is in his mid-80s, so he's not going to last very long, and he's jockeying to get his son to be the successor and to take over when he dies. And that's a very sensitive time for any regime, to be having a succession and to be simultaneously under attack by Israel. And of course, they chose to pursue a conflict with Israel during that sensitive period. So there was a question, would they retreat into their turtle shell and sort of hide from the world while they did a power succession, or would they be aggressive? Well, we know the answer because Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis have been very active, and that's what provoked Israel to go on this offensive. Well, Israel's now got the upper hand, not only by decimating Hamas and pushing back Hezbollah, but also ultimately we saw Syria collapse, which was a keystone to the Iranian strategic agenda in the region. What this means is that Iran is extremely vulnerable, and the Israelis have a huge opportunity. From Israel's point of view, this is the chance to reassert what is called the Begin Doctrine, prevent other countries in the region from obtaining nuclear weapons, set back that nuclear program, and also undermine the regime and try to make sure that when this succession process happens in Iran, that it's not just business as usual, but perhaps there'll be an opening for real political change in the country. Israel would be very reluctant to miss this opportunity, and certainly Benjamin Netanyahu would be. But I like to emphasize for listeners, this isn't all about personalities. You know, if Netanyahu falls from power because of internal political machinations, and suddenly you have a new prime minister of Israel, they still have an historic strategic opportunity to set back Iran and make sure they don't get a nuclear weapon. And the Americans are involved in this, obviously, because first of all, in order to truly cripple the nuclear program, Israel needs American support. The U.S. has also said it's a red line that Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons, and that's been under multiple presidencies. So the issue is that President Trump is interested in negotiating with Iran. He wants to freeze their nuclear program, but he has to start by enforcing the oil sanctions, which President Biden was not enforcing. Then he's putting maximum pressure on Iran. The supreme leader said, well, I don't want to talk to Trump. He's not reliable. And Israel's point of view is that it's probably better to ask for forgiveness than permission, meaning that they could escalate the conflict and draw the Americans into the conflict. So I think this is a true crisis point. I do put a date on it in saying it's in our 12-month forecast that this will be a major crisis. The crisis can be resolved by diplomacy. I would never say never. I would never say that there's no diplomatic solution, But the trends that I've witnessed over the past several years have convinced me that the diplomatic solution is lower probability. And that's specifically because the U.S. and Iran did work out a nuclear deal and it collapsed. And from Iran's point of view, the Americans betrayed it. From the American point of view, the Iranians never intended to really fulfill it in a good spirit. And so I think there's a lack of trust. And I think obviously Israel believes that, especially in the wake of what happened with Hamas. So all of this leads to a critical juncture. It leads to a conflict. The only way to stop it would be if President Trump uses military, overwhelming military threats to force Iran to freeze their nuclear program. So that means that we should expect the U.S. at some point to threaten Iran in a really significant way, looking as if we are going to attack them. The other thing is that President Trump would also have to restrain Israel, saying, look, I've got this. I'm in control. I can cause Iran to freeze their nuclear program, and then that way you don't have to go and do anything unilaterally. And Trump has to do both of those things in order for us to avoid a really major conflict this year. And I think the takeaway for investors is, first of all, we'll have the fire and fury when Trump is threatening Iran. Second of all, Iran will conduct strikes against oil facilities at least on a minor basis to show the risk of confronting Iran. And then third of all, if things go wrong, well, we may well end up with a big oil shock.
Sounds fairly likely. Obviously, we want to always leave room for something might work out. But go back over. You said two things have to happen. Two things have to happen. Trump has to do this and this has to happen. What are those two things again?
Trump has to threaten Iran with a credible threat that the U.S. is willing to conduct airstrikes so that they freeze their nuclear program without us having to do that.
Okay.
And the second part is he has to restrain Israel. He has to tell Israel, look, the United States is in control of the region and we are going to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon. And therefore, you do not need to take unilateral action.
So those two things are critical, and that's going to, that could blow the whole world up this year, or maybe not. I don't want to blow your horn too much, but I thought it was amazing when I read this, and it's like 75% probability. I'm like, wow, that just got my attention in a big way.
Well,
so,
if I could, I'd just say one thing about methodology and forecasting. Obviously, none of us know what's going to happen in the future. The key thing that in putting timeframes on this is what we see is that the Iranians have enough highly enriched uranium to build 10 nuclear devices in 1 month if they want to.
Wow.
And they have not yet made that decision to do that. We also see that conflict has already erupted in the region with Israel and with Iran. So there are direct hostilities already between the two players. Iran is expanding rather than freezing its nuclear program. And the new American administration is generally quite supportive of Israel and quite hardline on Iran. So those are the ingredients here. Whether this all materializes is an open question, but I would say that the urgency is a critical part of the analysis, where if Israel misses this opportunity, if they wait around for 5 years, they might have a less friendly U.S. administration. They might have a new regime in Iran. You know, if Iran has a succession process and they've got a new young leader where they're all feeling a lot more confident, and Iran might get more weapons support from Russia and China over that time period. So that's where we have a window of opportunity that says that this is really a more urgent issue for this year or maybe next year, as opposed to kicking the forecast down the line and saying, oh, at some point there will be a conflict.
Well, that's excellent in terms of the time frame and the urgency, because, you know, it's easy for us over here. I'm in Texas, you're in Kansas, and we're like, okay, well, yeah, that would have shook up the stock market, oil, the whole world. But if you lived in Israel, it would be a different story. To them, it's we've been embattled for our whole life, you know, since 1948, and it's an existential battle. We might not live through this if we don't take this action now, and here's our window of opportunity. That says a whole lot. So we'll see if Trump can be successful in working out something diplomatically or not. But it's what a risk to the world right now. Let's switch gears just a little bit, if you don't mind, and talk about some other conflicts in the world. Russia, Ukraine, you want to give us kind of an update on how you see that conflict playing right now?
Yeah, and it's moving very quickly over there right now because the U.S. Has sent its chief negotiator, Keith Kellogg, over to Europe, as well as the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth. So the talks are already happening. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has suggested that he's willing to negotiate with President Trump about, you know, some benefits that the Americans can get for helping Ukraine. He's willing to trade territory with Vladimir Putin. Of course, that is the reason why Ukraine invaded the Kursk area of Russia, was so that they would have some territory that they could try to trade off. Although, to be clear, it's about 1/6 of the territory that Russia holds. So it's nowhere near an equal trade-off. What's happening is the two armies are having trouble moving the battle lines substantially. Russia's sort of continually nibbling away, but Russia is running huge risks with its long-term social and economic stability by continuing this war. So just think about the Vietnam War, how the United States spent trillions of dollars and killed 60, 70,000 boys to wage this war. And it ended up over many decades leading to, it was one of the biggest factors leading to political polarization and partisanship being so out of control in the United States. And some of those were unintended consequences. Others were sort of direct consequences of the conflict. Wars are divisive by nature, especially gratuitous wars, or wars of choice, I should say. This was a war of choice. Russia wanted to prevent, they needed to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO, but they still had some diplomatic options to make that happen because there were NATO members that were willing to veto Ukraine joining NATO. And they decided, well, they thought that the diplomacy was a dead end. So maybe they made a rash decision, or maybe Vladimir Putin was just forward looking. Either way, they've now run these very large costs. So Ukraine is witnessing the Americans clearly are going to pull support. And voters elected Republicans because they were saying, look, inflation was too high and we need to cut some federal spending. And one of the areas that voters agree on needs to be cut is foreign aid, economic and military aid abroad. So there is a mandate to cut this. And President Trump is saying, well, we'll negotiate a peace treaty and then we can reduce this spending on Ukraine. That makes a ceasefire virtually a done deal. If the Americans pull back the funding, then Europe is not going to pick up the funding to keep Ukraine fighting. So that's why Zelensky is saying he's willing to negotiate.
Okay.
Europe is clearly willing to negotiate. They also are facing domestic pushback over inflation and spending for the war. The key player now is Russia, because if Russia is thinking about the long term and they're thinking about the health and stability of their economy and their households, then they will actually embrace a ceasefire, and it'll be drawn along the current line of control in the region, and it'll basically be a North-South Korea type situation where you do not have a peace treaty, you do not give any territory, you don't give much territory back, but you do have a decision to stop shooting each other. But if Putin, if he's too prideful and he doesn't embrace this olive branch, then he could push further, seeing that the Ukrainians don't have much support. And that would then force President Trump to, in Europe, to go back and huddle and decide, okay, we're going to come back with even greater support for Ukraine. That would launch an entirely new phase in the war. You know, Russia's interest rates are up to 21 or 22%. They're struggling with inflation. They don't get investment from the outside world anymore, not from the West. It's very difficult for them. And I think that Putin will take hold of the ceasefire opportunity. The question is the timing. Some of these things are hard to negotiate. In my sense, it could actually happen within the year. I think it's moving pretty quickly. And so in my outlook, I sort of said, well, we're going to see a decline in geopolitical risk around Ukraine and Eastern Europe, but we'll be out of the frying pan into the fire because this is heating up over in the Middle East. But if I'm wrong, what you'll see is that the negotiations will extend further into 2026, maybe even 2027. My bet is that really now that the writing is on the wall, Ukraine doesn't have many options and Russia needs to start looking after its own social stability. And so we'll see a ceasefire within the year or two.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I know I asked you this when you were in studio some months ago. You and I are both familiar, very familiar with a book called The Fourth Turning. Okay, let's assume that you're right and there is a ceasefire negotiation and territories remain about where they are now. What does that say for the long term, though? If you look at further out, was this just a one-off that Putin had? He's, okay, I'm going to take some of the turf back that we lost kind of thinking and make us proud of our country again? Or is there more of a strategic, no, this is the beginning of a move that's going to lead to another move like a chessboard for Russia specifically?
Yeah, good question. The driving factor here is that Russia, since the 1970s, has been in decay as a country. Right. And the Soviet Union collapsed, and then they lost a lot of territories that they controlled. And Putin represented this attempt to rebuild or reconstitute at least a few critical parts of that empire. And Ukraine, of course, used to be the core of Russia, and so it's the most critical. And Russian leaders are always willing to fight in Ukraine if they think a Western army is going to be permanently entrenched in Ukraine. And so on that basis, that's why Putin was willing to go to war in Ukraine. The problem is about the resources. Russia just has a shrinking population and extremely weak productivity, and it's weaker productivity now because, as I mentioned, Germany and Europe are no longer going to be investing in Russia very much. They're just a declining state, and the takeaway for all of us who are watching is that as this, it's a, you know, wounded and old, shaggy, dying sort of bear, but still extremely powerful. And right. the reactions are negative. It's like because Russia is decaying on the inside, they're striking out against others. And that's where you see them invade Georgia, Ukraine, and threaten the Baltic states. They don't have the capacity to wage a long-term war with NATO. Just draw up NATO's combined GDP versus Russia's, or NATO's combined military spending versus Russia's, or NATO's combined manpower versus Russia's. They have nuclear blackmail. That's a very important weapon. Mm-hmm. And they have the ability to manipulate oil output. Although even there, if they cut off their oil output, they damage their own oil production over the long run. What I'm underscoring is that this was pretty specific to Ukraine. This was Russia saying, no, Ukraine doesn't get to join NATO. This was NATO kind of accepting, okay, Ukraine doesn't get to join NATO. And then a few other neutral powers, Finland and Sweden, saying, okay, well, if Russia's going to be invading people, we want to be part of NATO. And that was it. That was the episode here. Now what happens is Russia, there's two key issues. One is in the coming 5, 10, 15 years, eventually Putin will go one way or another. Mm-hmm. Will the new leadership continue to pursue foreign aggression? As a, you've got domestic instability, do they continue to project that outward and be aggressive? That could lead to some really irrational and dangerous threats. Otherwise, they will have a more managed process where they combine with China and they play the junior partner in a Chinese alliance, which is basically bent at creating an alternative world system to the U.S. system. And it'll be rooted in Eurasia. It'll be rooted in Central Asia, Russia, China, parts of South Asia and the Middle East. It won't be hinging on necessarily invading anyone because they'll lack the capability. So those are the sort of two outcomes. The one that's most dangerous for global stability is one where they continue to be aggressive, because if they're aggressive in Georgia, Ukraine, well, that doesn't trip the NATO self-defense clause. But if they're aggressive toward Lithuania or Finland or in the Baltic Sea, they can trip the collective defense of NATO, and then we end up with a larger conflict.
All right. May you live in interesting times, the old Chinese proverb. Speaking of which, since the, again, we've read, both of us read the Fourth Turning book, and I don't want to overemphasize it, but I don't want to ignore it either. I want to bring up China next. So you're talking about Russia may, you know, maybe they'll back off, maybe they won't. But the bottom line is the world to me, I mean, I look at a lot of unstable players. I look at Iran, I look at North Korea, and China in particular is talking, you know, as you know, because you pointed it out, I read your materials, and I know it was other people that backed it up, that apparently we were told that China could invade and take over Taiwan as early as 2028. It looks like a new axis of evil might be basically created here. Speak to a little bit about what you see China doing. I know right now their real estate market is just a bubble that popped, and it was it's still enormous, and it's still not played out. It's still not through their system yet. They've had a once-in-a-generation, once-in-a-century movement to industrialize from the farms to the cities, and I don't like the power structure over there, clearly. So tell me a little bit about what your view of China is, both short and long-term.
The first thing to recognize is that the Communist Party never gave up state control, and under Xi Jinping, they have really consolidated that control. And what that means is that the Communist Party is in charge of the state bureaucracy, the central government. The central government in Beijing is in charge of the provinces and clawing back power from the provinces. And the core of China, you know, the kind of Beijing, Shanghai core of China is in charge of all the other regions. So that we saw over the past 15 years, 20 years, they have cracked down on Tibet and Xinjiang, and they removed Hong Kong's special rights and privileges that were borne down from British colonial rule. So this is a consolidating empire. It's a sort of dynasty under the Communist Party. The belief is that the Western democracies are constantly erratic and changing their minds, incapable of formulating long-term policy. And so when the West comes to China and says, well, you really need to help us rebalance global trade for the sake of global stability, meaning that you should open up your markets so that we can export to your consumers. Your consumers can gain purchasing power through different reforms and import more Western goods and services, and then we can balance out our trade relationship. And then there's not going to be so much fear and distrust and hostility about a wealthier and more powerful China. Well, the problem with that is that the Communist Party would need to transfer wealth and assets to the household sector. Right now in China, a great deal of assets are held by state-owned enterprises, state-controlled banks, local governments in their vehicles, as well as even the military has a large role in the economy, has ownership of land and other assets. So you'd have to privatize these things, and that would then allow households to operate them, take these assets, operate them commercially to make money and get a good return. A new group of entrepreneurs, and eventually they would become elites because they would make a lot of money. And the Communist Party is sort of worried about this. On the one hand, it would be good. The households would be wealthier. You'd have a freer market. You'd be generating more growth. But on the other hand, you'd have this new rich faction that would think that it has its own prerogatives. It would say, oh, you know, we need to have a say in how we are taxed, or we need to have a say in how government spending is done, or we need to have a say in foreign policy or social policy. And that would effectively look like a democracy. That pressure, that public and social pressure from the households, is something that the Communist Party just refuses to allow. And so what you end up with is an economic model that's built entirely around the state, and the state driving investment and overproducing goods, which are then exported abroad. So we saw this. All of this story is very familiar, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard this before in terms of, you know, the investment and export-driven economic model of China. But even if you just look at the statistics in 2024, meaning that everything you've heard your whole life about China, just in the last year, the statistics show us that they fell back on exporting. Exports in the fourth quarter made up 40% of their growth, which is really incredible. They also have not empowered consumption. Consumption continues to be an extremely anemic part of the GDP equation. Household consumption is about 40% of GDP. It's extremely low compared to other countries. So they're overinvesting, overproducing, and overexporting, and it's generating these trade tensions with the outside world. And what's interesting in the West is that we point to Donald Trump and we say, oh, he's a nasty protectionist. But what you're witnessing is, in fact, the reaction in the West to China's refusal to reform and rebalance. Now, to be fair to China, the Americans are not really rebalancing either. It's not as if Americans are saving a lot more. You know, we overconsume. Maybe we need to come back and cut our federal budget, raise our interest rates, and save more. You know, but neither the U.S. nor China is willing to undertake structural change, and instead we're engaging in sort of a game of chicken. But China has the assurance under Xi Jinping that if they just barrel through with their current strategy, which is invest in research and development and high technology and export, move up the manufacturing value chain and export to the rest of the world, their view is that the democracies will come and go and they'll be chaotic and incoherent and there won't be a calculated and unified response from the West, so that they'll basically get away with it. And in the end, China will have an even larger share of global manufacturing, and they'll have a more advanced manufacturing. And that advanced technological component can then also be shared with their military, which it is, under a principle of civil-military fusion, in order to ensure that their military modernization program makes them more capable of defending themselves and expanding a sphere of influence in East Asia, pushing back American influence. So all of this is the big story. You know, this makes the Iran story that we talked about actually quite small in comparison. The Iran conflict is, you know, we've seen wars in the Middle East. We've seen conflicts in the Middle East and they come and go, sort of an aspect, a perennial aspect of the world we live in. But what's a true change is China emerging as a competitor to the U.S., the U.S. struggling to come up with a coherent and durable strategic response, and China refusing to make the economic adjustments that would be necessary to pacify the Americans and prevent further distrust and further armament, you know, in the direction of conflict.
That's all great analysis. It gives us a wonderful backdrop to the whole thing, but bottom line, what do you think is going to happen with Hong Kong? With Taiwan.
Taiwan, exactly. Well, and that's the thing. Is think about what Hong Kong taught Taiwanese people. Taiwanese people prefer to be liberal, democratic, capitalistic, part of the international society. They don't want to be ruled by Beijing and the Communist Party. That's the essence of Taiwan. That's why Taiwan exists, coming out of the civil war in China. And they look over, and in 2019, China reneges on an agreement made with Britain and under the eyes of all the world in the 1997, saying, well, Hong Kong is going to get to retain a lot of aspects of British Commonwealth law. And the common law is important for capitalism. It's important for investors to believe in an independent judiciary and the upholding of contracts and private property, free press to help patrol, you know, the government and make accountability and transparency part of the system. All of these things were removed. And from Taiwan's point of view, it was the perfect example of how if you allow the Communist Party to take hold and to take control on the promise that they will grant you an exemption and grant you exceptions, well, later what you'll find out is, no, they're still the Communist Party and they're going to take your rights away. Yep. And that's, of course that's true. And of course it was naive for Britain and America and everyone to think that Hong Kong was going to be able to retain their rights. But anyway, it happened. So from Taiwan's perspective, there is no accommodation. I mean, they have to continue trading with China. It's too big a part of their economy to, and they ultimately, some of them ultimately believe it would be basically, about 10% believe it would be great if someday they could reunite as Chinese. About 30 or 35% believe that they need to be an independent country. And that's actually the party that's in power right now. And the other 55 to 60% believe, well, we can just keep this status quo going forever. You know, we should just never resolve the issue because it'll be too big of a conflict. As long as China and the United States maintain a balance of power and an understanding with each other, then that status quo probably can be prolonged. But what's rupturing the status quo today is all the things I talked about with China. Those things make the U.S. nervous. And specifically, they think China is getting more aggressive around Taiwan, rattling sabers, and using economic sanctions, and that's going to continue, even to the point of using some like hybrid or gray zone military tactics to pressure Taiwan. So that's going to be going as just an element of China expanding their sphere of influence. But then the Americans are worried about it because if we lose Taiwan, then we lose influence and credibility. We lose our security alliance with, or let's say the stability of our alliance with South Korea, Japan, the Philippines. All those countries start to think, oh gosh, the Americans aren't able to defend us, and therefore we had better accommodate ourselves to Chinese rule in some way. Now, of course, the Japanese will never do that. Instead, they'll get nuclear weapons, and then we'll have an even more dangerous brewing tensions in the region, and the Americans will have less influence over the whole affair. And I haven't even mentioned semiconductors, which are sort of the obvious example of how the U.S. economy would be negatively impacted, hugely negatively impacted, if a conflict erupted. What this tells us is that Taiwanese are not going to be the ones to trigger a war, knowing that they're at ground zero. The Trump administration, you know, I don't want to read too much into Trump himself or his rhetoric. He's been, you could argue that he's been somewhat dovish, meaning not eager to have a conflict over Taiwan. But what I would say is that effectively Trump is going to try to uphold the status quo. So then the question boils down to China. And will they continue to push for greater influence in ways that become unacceptable to Taiwan and the United States? And as their economy declines, will they go the Russian path where you have internal instability and you start projecting that outward in the form of aggression? If they do that, then we'll end up with a much more dangerous standoff and ultimately probably a conflict. But here's hoping that they really don't go in that Russian direction where they think, well, instead what we should do is we should at least somewhat reform our economy and at least somewhat maintain our trade relationships with the U.S. and Europe. And then that way we don't become a hermetic kingdom, like a hermit kingdom like North Korea, and we don't end up in a major conflict where we squander our wealth and our influence by trying to retake this fortified mountainous island.
So best case scenario, obviously, is maintaining the status quo somewhat and hoping China does not get too aggressive. That sound right?
I think that's right. And from the American point of view, of course, you've got to actually try to do something about this to ensure. And the issue is that it's very sensitive. It's very tricky. You've got to provide enough deterrence that China knows that attacking Taiwan is just a fool's errand. But you cannot over-deter. You cannot become provocative yourself in a way that convinces China that it is inevitable that the Americans will take advantage of them, because then they would have an incentive to go ahead and prevent that from happening. So I think the Trump administration's challenge is to calibrate the Taiwan policy. And every administration has had this problem, how to calibrate. It's becoming a bigger problem today because China's economy is failing and the U.S. is applying economic pressure, tech controls, and tariffs. And that means we're headed toward a larger conflict. And so now managing that strategic part is more difficult because there's a lot less trust.
Last question. This excellent interview, Matt. South China Sea. I know that a lot has been made of the ships, Chinese Navy, making a show of force around the South China Sea, which I guess geographically, I suppose that's kind of south of Japan. What do you make of that? Is that just, we want to make sure that you don't try to bully us, or no, we're trying to take over this turf and this is our turf?
Yeah, it's more of the latter. And, you know, the Americans over time effectively created a sphere of influence in the Caribbean. And President Trump has now reminded everyone of this by saying, calling attention to the sacrifices that America made to build the Panama Canal and saying that we're going to take it back.
Okay.
And he's also done that by referring to Greenland, basically applying the Monroe Doctrine to Greenland and saying, why should Denmark rule Greenland? Now, these are parts of a negotiation that Trump is doing to get Panama to give the U.S. some benefits and get Denmark to pay more for Greenland. That's understood. But what I'm saying is that powerful countries create spheres of influence. Mm-hmm. Now, when China started to emerge in the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, they're building a navy and they're looking at American strategy and British strategy in other countries saying, we need a sphere of influence. And in particular, we need greater control over the critical sea lines of communication that bring goods that are essential to our economy over the ocean. So they started to look to the South China Sea and say that they wanted to create a sphere of influence the way that the Americans did. And in 1898, when America wanted to assert a sphere of influence in the Caribbean, Spain was a joke. The Spanish empire had been collapsing at that point for 300 years, you know, or 250 years. But China is wanting to assert a sphere of influence today where the American empire is not necessarily, if anything, the American empire is sort of reasserting itself.
Right.
Now, what is the significance of it? One, it's just all the trade that takes place in the South China Sea. But the other is that, of course, these are the supply lines for Taiwan as well. Hmm. And ultimately, I think we should think of the South China Sea really, first, it's a sphere of influence in general for China's imports. And they ultimately, they want to gain control of the Strait of Malacca, where Singapore is. They want to have overwhelming influence all the way to Singapore. And they want to be able to express power into the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf, as well as into the Western Pacific. But a critical part of the South China Sea story is simply having the military ability to cut off Taiwan's supplies and to cut off Taiwan in the event that they have a conflict. So we should see those as connected. And the Americans are just asserting our right to sail through the South China Sea and our right to have independent relationships with the different parties. But we're also doing something else. We're also sort of trying to make sure that we maintain a good strategic position in case there's a fight. So we went to the Philippines under the Biden administration and we reformulated our defense agreements so that we could operate out of our bases in the Philippines. All of this is telling you that turf battles are reemerging, ancient turf battles. I do think as a concluding remark here, we should recognize the very fact that countries are talking about territory and territorialism and taking territory, that should leave you uneasy as a investor. Now, and I appreciate, Jerry, that you said earlier, I'm not an alarmist. I don't come on to just hype geopolitical risks and make everybody stuff their money under the mattress. That's not the point. But look at the gold price. And Jerry, you know this, and we've talked about it before. What is the gold price telling you about the status of global stability? It's saying, uh-oh, global instability is a recurring theme. It's a rising trend. And a big part of it is that when Russia starts to decide, I want this piece of territory, and they take it by force. When China decides, I want these territories, I'm going to take them by force. And when the Americans even start talking about it, if only just to tell everybody, well, hey, put Russia and China on notice that we can play that game too if they really want to do that, fine. But the point is that you're starting to enter into true geopolitical. This is why we say geopolitics. It has to do with geo, earth, territory. And now we're getting into disagreements that are actually a lot harder to resolve than just debating about shaving a few more points off of tariff levels,
right,
or orchestrating a few more swap lines between our central banks. So I think we should just be guarded about this. And I think for 2025, the key risk is the Middle East. But I think for the four-year term of Trump, clearly China, Taiwan, that's going to be the big risk.
Wow. Excellent. Awesome interview. Great information. You don't hear really. I subscribe to a lot of different people, but I don't get the information like I do from you. So I appreciate this a lot. You being with us, Matt. Awesome interview as usual. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that means a lot to me. Thank you, Jerry.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA/SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services, an independent financial group, LLC, or unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.